Matthew 15, 29, we're going to cover in one fell swoop tonight more text than we have covered in, gosh, months and months and months. We're going to cover quite a large section of text. And the reason is we have two doublets in our text tonight. Doublets are an exegete's way to say it's a repetition. It's the story told again, but with just some minor variations. And that's important because we read. 100% of us probably in this room read. In the ancient world, 2,000 years ago, maybe 1 out of 100 of us could read. At best, 5 out of 100 of us could read. So you have an oral culture where people are listening, they're not reading, and when you're only able to listen to the word proclaimed, repetition provides a very important feature in that it underscores and highlights the importance of something because you're repeating it. That's the way you make sure that someone knows that story is important. And so what Matthew has done immediately following the account of healings that Mike went over last week, Matthew's going to repeat the feeding story with just a few slight modifications. He's going to repeat the demand for a test of Jesus from the Pharisees, but with again some minor modifications, all in order to underscore the new text, the new bit of scripture we have, the yeast of the Pharisees, which is what we're going to focus on after we see how those two repetitions highlight what's really going on in this warning about the yeast of the Pharisees. And so we're going to try to go through verse 29 and 15 all the way to verse 12 of 16. That's a pretty big chunk. We haven't done that in a while. So follow along if you would with me. Last week, Mike covered verse 29. Jesus left there and went along the Sea of Galilee. Then he went up on a mountainside and sat down. Great crowds came to him, bringing the lame, the blind, the crippled, the mute, and many others, and laid them at his feet, and he healed them. The people were amazed when they saw the mute speaking, the crippled made well, the lame walking, and the blind seeing, and they praised the God of Israel. So a massive amount of messianic signs. That when Messiah would come, the lame would walk, the blind would see, the deaf would hear, and there's this praising of the God of Israel, praising the God who has manifested God's self in and through the person of Jesus Christ. I'm sure Mike covered that and more as he covered that bit of section here, but that leads you into verse 32. Jesus called his disciples to him and said, and now you're going to get a bit of deja vu. I have compassion for these people. They've already been with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. I do not want to send them away hungry or they may collapse on the way. And just like our previous encounter with this feeding, his disciples answer, where could we get enough bread in this remote place to feed such a crowd? Verse 34, how many loaves do you have? Jesus asked. 7, they replied, and a few small fish. Now this should sound relatively familiar. There's a couple of new features. We've seen before this feeding miracle that's about to occur, and we'll read in a moment. But we encounter a few new elements, and one of them is that this is taking place on a mountain. That's why I had to go all the way back to verse 29, that Jesus left, went along the Sea of Galilee, and he went up on a mountainside, just like the Sermon on the Mount is the new law, where Moses received the law on Mount Tabor. Now Jesus presents the Sermon on the Mount, the law through the Christ on that mount. Now we see the Messiah fulfilling what the prophets have said, that when Messiah comes, people will stream up on a mountainside and there'll be a feast. There'll be plenty for all. And so this messianic prophecy, repeated again and again throughout many of the prophets, is coming true in the sight of his disciples. Unfortunately, his disciples are just as clueless as ever. I mean, you would think, and you kind of think, knock, 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 is anyone home? Where are we going to get enough bread? Just a chapter and a half ago, we have the feeding of the 5,000, but that doesn't seem to stick. And instead, you get this language of diminished resources, that we don't have enough. We can't possibly do this. In fact, verse 24b, we have a few small fish. So not only do we have not an opportunity to have the resources, all we've got is just a few, and they're very, very small. Well, that's what the church always has. We have diminished resources. We don't have unlimited resources. We have a few. We have some small fish. And we always ask ourselves, where are we going to get enough? We have nothing here. But what we need to remember is a few small fish are enough if God is involved. That will get the job done. The disciples are having to have this lesson placed before them a second time because they just aren't getting it. Why can't it get into their head that with God they will have enough? And I would argue the same reason it doesn't get into our head. The same reason we still have meetings about, oh, we just don't have enough. Where will we get this? We only have a few small and fill in the blank. That we just continually have that language of diminished resources and of an inability to do what we could do or should do because there's just simply not enough. And yet Jesus is inviting them to imagine that there's some greater force involved and that that small gift may just be enough. And that leads to the miracle that we've seen before. Verse 35, he told the crowd to sit down on the ground. He took the 7 loaves and the fish. And when he'd given thanks, now we have Eucharistic language. He gives thanksgiving. He breaks them just like I break the bread when we have communion. He gave them to his disciples and they in turn gave to the people. So now they're part of this giving. They all ate and were satisfied. Afterward, the disciples picked up 7 baskets full of broken pieces that were left over. The number of those who ate was about 4,000 besides women and children. After Jesus sent the crowd away, he got into the boat and went to the vicinity of Magadan. So we have this same sign again, this sign of the plenty on the mountaintop, the feast that is there because Messiah has arrived, and how the disciples are charged in disseminating the small gifts that they have in order to feed and to aid those who are in need. That then leads to another repetition, another deja vu. We've seen this story before, at least once before, but possibly twice. Verse 1 of chapter 16, the Pharisees and the Sadducees came to Jesus and tested him by asking him to show them a sign from heaven. Now, this time we start with what's the same. This isn't the first test. We've seen the Pharisees come before just a few chapters earlier in chapter 12. But what's interesting is the word for testing Jesus is the same word that is used of the tempter in Matthew 4. Tempting, testing Jesus 3 times in the wilderness. So you get hints of the fact that the tempter that's never really left the environment is speaking through and working through these interlocutors, through these Pharisees. But now it's not just the Pharisees. This is what's different. Jesus' enemies are mounting. They're multiplying. Now, it's not just the Pharisees as before in chapter 12. Now, we have some unlikely bed partners. Pharisees and Sadducees hate each other. They don't like each other one bit. Pharisees are pious, godly people committed to devotion to the law, committed to resurrection from the dead, committed to making sure they do everything they can to keep themselves unspotted by the Gentile world. The Sadducees are wealthy elitists who don't mind at all interacting with the Gentile world because they have money, they have power, they don't believe in resurrection because when you're wealthy and you got it pretty good here, there's not much cause to think about another life to come. And so they're pretty content having the political reins of power upon them. And so Sadducees and Pharisees are worse than you could ever imagine from the entrenched positions of Democrat and Republican in our society. They don't get along. Now, can you imagine Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton joining forces in order to do the same thing? That's what's happening here, if not even worse. So you have this multiplying of enemies together, and they are doing this not because they're curious. They're not curious at all. They're not asking a legitimate question. They have an agenda. And in their testing of Jesus, just like the testing of the tempter, there is a desire to discredit him, to undermine his ministry, to prove him to be the phony that both of these entrenched sides believe that he is. For the Pharisees, he's not pious enough. For the Sadducees, he upsets the systems of power too much. Neither one likes him. They'd like to trump his agenda. And so Jesus replies, and this is where you also get just a little bit more, because before he's just said, only the sign of Jonah is what I'm going to give you, but now he gives them a little bit more biting response. Verse 2, he replied, when evening comes, you say, it will be fair weather, for the sky is red. And in the morning, today it will be stormy, for the sky is red and overcast. You know the old red sky at night, sailor's delight, red sky at morning, sailors take warning because of the reddish glow at morning or evening in the west or in the east with the haze and the clouds can indicate weather that's coming up, particularly when you don't have the handy device called a television and a weather reporter, and you can hear what the weather's going to be. You do your best to read the signs, to know what that day is going to be, because that matters in the ancient world just as much as it does in ours. So Jesus says, you guys read signs pretty well when it comes to meteorological signs. You're very, very good at seeing what's obvious and evident in looking for signs. But, verse 4, a wicked and adulterous generation. And those are fighting words. Those are the words the prophets used of the most wicked and impious and undevoted and covenant-breaking people in the prophetic books. It's wicked and adulterous. You not only do evil, but you show no faithfulness to the one God. So a wicked and adulterous generation looks for a miraculous sign, but none will be given it except the sign of Jonah. Jesus then left them and went away. So they're not really looking for a sign. If they were looking for a sign, they'd see it. That's why he says, you know, you can judge the weather by just looking at the signs. If you're really looking for a sign, you'd find it. But he's condemning the blindness to all the signs and miracles that he's doing, that they've heard of, that others have seen, and their inability to connect that to the fact that God may be working in and through Christ to inaugurate the kingdom. They cannot fathom it, neither one. And that leads to our new story. The yeast of the Pharisees. And it's important to have those two stories before this because both wrap themselves up in what's about to happen. The disciples are watching all this. They've been there at the feedings. They've been there when the people have come with their agenda to discredit Jesus, both times. And so now, verse 5, when they went across the lake, the disciples forgot to take bread. They forgot to pack lunch. And that doesn't seem like an important detail until you read what's about to happen. So they forget to bring lunch. They just pop in their boat, go across the lake. Verse 6, Jesus gives them a warning. Be careful, Jesus said to them. Be on your guard against the yeast of the Pharisees and Sadducees. And so that connects to our sign story, what he's just experienced in the testing. The disciples, verse 7, discussed this among themselves and said, hey, it's because we didn't bring any bread. So obviously, again, the cluelessness is at high. They don't understand at all what he's saying. And you can understand because Jesus said, beware of the yeast. And they immediately just think, well, this has to be about the fact we forgot to pack lunch. We must be getting scolded for forgetting to bring proper rations. Perhaps we should have brought some leftovers from the feeding of the 4,000. Maybe Jesus is upset that we just didn't prepare for this like we should. And so they're arguing and discussing among themselves. And in verse 8, we read, aware of their discussion, Jesus asked, you of little faith, why are you talking among yourselves about having no bread? Do you still not understand? And now we connect to the feeding story. Don't you remember the 5 loaves for the 5,000 and how many basketfuls you gathered? Or the 7 loaves for the 4,000 and how many basketfuls you gathered? So you see how we're connecting. And Jesus said, you know, bread's never a problem, guys. If we need to eat, that's not going to be an issue. You should know that by now. Our meager resources do not limit the abilities of what we can do and what God's going to do through us. So that's not the problem. I don't know why you're reverting back to that as the main issue. Verse 11, how is it that you don't understand? So twice he says, you don't understand. Don't you remember? Why don't you understand? I'm not talking to you about bread. But be on your guard against the yeast of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. Now, before we consider what that yeast might be, let me invite you to gain some small amount of encouragement by how clueless the disciples are. They don't get it. They don't seem to remember anything. These people who had seen more signs than anyone else in our biblical story, they had heard Jesus' teaching from the Sermon on the Mount. They had seen His healings, numerous healings we've read about so far in Matthew. They've seen Him cast out demons and calm a storm and walk on water and multiply loaves and fish twice. And after all of that, they misunderstand so much. So don't be so hard on yourself when you're trying your best to walk by faith without all of these signs that we all would be glad to see, that you find it difficult to remember and that you find it difficult to understand, because it doesn't seem like they're learning anything. And as hard and as critical as we may want to be on the Pharisees and Sadducees, the disciples understand not much more at this point, no more than those who were Jesus' own enemies. And so we get a sense right here that the way Matthew's portraying the disciples, they're just as dense as the enemies. However, there is a little glimmer of hope. There's a few rays where you see that Jesus, in His patience with them, is beginning to see small signs of intelligence. That there is some brain matter being used, because in verse 12, then they understood that He was not telling them to guard against the yeast used in bread, but against the teaching of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. So this yeast of the Pharisees and the Sadducees is, in one way, their teaching. Now, what's going on there when we talk about teaching? We live in a society, and sometimes we walk among church folk that think, you know, dogma, teaching, not really important, just matters what we do. Doesn't matter what we really teach. Teaching is kind of secondary to action. And what we find is that Jesus warns against this error in teaching that is small. Yeast. You may remember just a few, months back, we looked at a parable where we talked about the parable of the yeast. And how this little thing called yeast can have a pervasive and powerful impact on the whole. And Jesus says the kingdom of heaven is like yeast. And it starts out small, but it ends up pervading the whole. Now, the way we talked about it was that your small kingdom actions have an influence and an impact far greater than you'd ever imagine. But it's also equally true that error, or completely misunderstanding what God's doing in Christ, even though it might seem like a small thing, may completely and utterly, like yeast was for the Jews, make the whole bread impure. Because for the most part, Jews, when they ate bread, particularly on holy days, would remove all the leaven. They'd remove all the yeast. Because they saw yeast in their holy rituals as things that made bread impure, and you wanted to keep that out so you had just a flat bread that did not rise, and in doing that you were following the law that talked about making sure there was no hint of leaven or yeast in your household. Well, that's just to suggest that yeast is a powerful force. It has a pervasive influence, and yeast can be looked at in a good light and a bad light. It has a powerful influence, but when you're trying to remove all yeast or leaven and it still shows up, then all of a sudden you realize how just a small little thing can have a very big impact. Which is all to say this, as we move into reflections, that the power of yeast goes both ways. That there is a sense in which small things can have a powerful influence. The small reality that I'm to love God with all my heart, soul, strength, and mind, love my neighbor as myself, welcome the outsider, welcome the marginalized, live at peace, try to pray for my enemies and seek to love my enemies, all these things that Jesus highlights in His Sermon on the Mount, those things have a pervasive influence through small actions and large. But when we remove those elements and we all of a sudden say, well, faith is more about national interests and making sure we have the greatest security we could possibly have. Or faith is about making sure that you give your enemies their just desserts, not praying for them or seeking their good. Faith is about making sure that any enemies are condemned instead of judge not lest ye be judged. And on you can go. And these small little influences, particularly with the Pharisees, thinking Jesus is impious because He's welcoming the sinner. Those little influences so colored their good faith, their pious actions, their devotion to Torah, that it corrupted the whole. That's what Jesus is saying here. That yeast corrupted it all because it took away the very heart of what Jesus is trying to promote with the yeast of the kingdom of God that has come to welcome sinners, to reach out to the marginalized, to help the helpless, to call people to peace instead of violence, to invite people to reconciliation instead of condemnation, that he's inviting to us a whole new way of being and a way of being God's kingdom and God's people. That a small little adjustment in just the wrong direction can cause the whole thing to spiral to where it's no good at all. Now, I don't have to go into details to say you all know how just one or two really crazy ideas can cause just something very good to derail. It doesn't take much. I would imagine that there are many, many very good and godly churches that have very strong commitments to God and to God's cause and to God's law that sometimes undermine it with the condemnations they toss out to those that they're called to love. I mean, it's just easy to see how that could happen. I could also see how churches devoted to great social causes can undermine their cause by saying, you know, Jesus is kind of optional. It's not, the kingdom's not really that important. So that it's very easy to see how we can take one small thing and eclipse the whole, and that seems to be what Jesus is getting at, and that seems to be what the disciples are beginning to understand. That whatever this kingdom thing is that Jesus is about, that's connected to the Sermon on the Mount, and the signs that he's doing, and all that's going on around him, that must be kept at the center, and outside things must not be allowed to eclipse it, and the way of the Pharisees and the way of the Sadducees is not the way. So Jesus does what sometimes we're afraid to do. He says, that's not the way, and that's not the way. You need to stick to the way. You need to make sure that you beware and be on your guard against the leaven of the Pharisees. And that then leads us to wrestle with, well, then what is going on with these signs that the Pharisees and Sadducees seem to be interested in but really are not, and how do we read the signs that Jesus does in his kingdom ministry? One of the things we know about signs, and I've talked about this before, so forgive me for repetition, but signs always point to something. Signs are never the point. I've talked before about how you don't go to tell your kids we're going to Walt Disney World, and you get to the point where you arrive at the sign and you say, there it is, kids, and it's great, and you turn back around and go home. Or you're looking for a hotel and you see a sign for a hotel and you, well, I'm here now. You're not. The sign's never the point. The sign is meant to point. That's what a sign does. It points to something else. So that all these signs that Jesus are doing are meant to point to something, and what they're meant to point to is Jesus. That Jesus is God's kingdom presence. Jesus is indeed God's King, the Messiah. Come, and these signs are evidence as he heals the sick and exercises the demons and calms the storms and walks on waters. He is doing that which evidences that he is God's chosen Savior. And because of that, we sometimes think that signs may need to be a little bit more obvious, a little bit more extreme. If you think about it, the Pharisees said, we want to see a sign from heaven. You know, we don't want any of these small little signs. We want a big one, a miraculous. And Jesus even highlights in his response, verse 4, a wicked and adulterous generation looks for miraculous signs. They you want the big stuff, the big dramatic stuff. That's what you're looking for. But it's always interesting to me that in the Gospels, the biggest signs of Jesus and who he is are very easy to mistake and not see. The shepherds are told at Bethlehem, you shall see a sign. This will be a sign for you. A babe wrapped in swaddling clothes lying in a manger. Really? A baby in a crib? Or the greatest sign of all, I can't tell you how many times in my 23 years of ministry people have said, I need a sign that God loves me, and I grieve, I lament, my heart just wants to crack open in frustration and disappointment because the sign's there. There's no greater sign, but it's pretty easy to misread and misunderstand that God would give in Christ everything. The crucified Messiah. That would be God's sign, that God so loved that God gave the only begotten Son. That God's love would be demonstrated in an act so extreme, so hostile, so prone to misunderstanding that we could easily miss it and be looking for other more dramatic signs when the greatest sign has been given. Well, that then leads to what I think is really encouraging for us as Jesus' disciples, because, you know, Jesus in verse 8 might seem like he's chastising, but boy, I would argue he's actually being very patient, because he's dealing with dimwits. He's dealing with dullards. They are clueless. They seem to be making no progress at all. And if I'm honest with myself and my walk with Christ, I know exactly how it is to sit in those shoes. To be one that's in the environment of and cognizant of and engaged with all of these realities where God is at work, and to be just as dull and senseless to the signs of God's work in my own life. But Jesus, in his chastisement, in verse 8, "You of little faith, why are you talking? Don't you understand?" And then he gives them things to remember. How is it that you don't understand? And what you realize is, thank God Jesus doesn't just throw his hands up in the air and walk out on his disciples and say, "You guys are just frustrating to no end. I'm sick of you. I'm sick of the fact that you don't seem to remember anything and you don't seem to ever learn anything." But instead, Jesus, with us, like with his disciples, stays with us and continues to invite us through questions to further faith, to try to get what we haven't got again and again and again, and he does it until we finally get it. That's his patience. That's his faithfulness. And that's why in verse 12, we see that they finally do get it. They finally see, then they understood. He's telling them to guard, not just against, you know, not having a proper lunch, but against, in some way, the Pharisees and the Sadducees' emphases are pointing them in the wrong direction and not in the way Jesus would invite them to go. So that we see in the disciples a very slow growth. But slowly the blinders come off. Not because they're so intelligent. Not because they have such an enlightened spirit. Not because they're so spiritually sensitive, but because Jesus is so tenaciously patient and faithful. They really aren't any further advanced than the Pharisees and Sadducees. They just stand under the tutelage of this patient master who says, "I'm sticking with you till you guys get it. And I'm going to keep reminding you until you see it." And they begin to see it, but what really is the ultimate sign that all of this slow growth is really producing fruit is in our next passage, which we'll look at next week. Because you see the header? In the next passage, and this is where doing this exercise that we're doing is so fruitful. We have now seen them experience all these signs. They seem to be just as dull. They're slowly opening blinded eyes. And now all of a sudden, out of nowhere, Jesus is going to hit them with the question, "Who do people say the Son of Man is?" And Peter is going to be able to say, "You are the Christ, the Son of God." And Jesus is going to say, "Blessed are you, Simon of Bar-Jonah." He's going to be able to confess a confession that you and I could do no better than embracing as well. That Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. Now, it's still going to take him some time to fully live into that. But he's finally seeing that all of these signs seem to point toward him being the Christ. And that's what all the signs are for. The signs are for eventually Peter and his disciples actually saying, "Oh, we see, we see where these signs lead, and we believe, even though the Pharisees are against you and the Sadducees are against you, these two main representatives of religious authorities that we would hold with great honor and understand that they have value in our society, that they are not getting it. and that you are inviting us to a higher road, a different calling, a nobler way, a way that allows us to see that you, in your kingdom presentation and in your kingdom living, are calling us to the way of Messiah. That will be a huge moment, but of course the moment will be fading, because then when Jesus says, "I've got to go to the cross," Peter will say, "God forbid you go to the cross." And then Jesus has to say, "Get behind me, Satan." There's your discipleship. That's what it's like to grow as a disciple. One minute you make the greatest statement, you do the greatest thing, you do something that's so ennobling, and God says, "Bless you, my child." And the next moment we have to hear, "Hey, you're in the way of the evil one again. You're just spouting the language of the kingdom of darkness again. Shut up. Get back on track." And Jesus keeps moving with his disciples, keeps moving with them, keeps teaching them in his patience, because he's aware that a little leaven goes both ways. A little leaven can eclipse a lot of good. A little leaven can actually produce something far more than you'd ever imagine when it's the good leaven of the kingdom. So that's what we see in this passage before us. We'll look next week at Peter's confession of the Christ. As our worship team is coming forward, any questions or thoughts? By the way, next week is the center of the book. We get right to the center because the confession and the transfiguration form the meat of Matthew's sandwich. They're right directly in the center of his book, which shows how important these sections are that we're coming up to. Any questions or thoughts or comments about tonight's story or Matthew up to this point as our worship team makes their way up here? Yeah, Frank. And as Sophie's come in, I surprised them. Holy, sorry. Sorry there, Karen Grace. I can repeat, though. I can hear you, and then I'll repeat it until she gets it up here.
I was thinking about leaven and how it spreads. In our technology today, you make a mistake on a computer.
Yep.
You send a message with the wrong information.
Yep.
And then trying to pull it back.
That's a great, great point. Can I repeat it? Frank made a more contemporary, modern connection to yeast. You know, yeast is old school. It still works, obviously. But imagine what happens when someone puts a wrong Facebook post, or a video becomes viral, or you place some wrong information out, and those who are ready to just eat up that information because it fits their stories, shoots it out and disseminates it, and then you have to kind of find out, well, it either wasn't true, or it was harmful, it wasn't right. So that's a great, great example of how something little like that, at the same time, a small little message, like a viral video, something that just a family makes of a cute thing a puppy dog does, can have a million views, and you know, you there have the positive side if you like puppies and doing cute things. And if you don't, you really need to check your heart. Check your heart. All right. you get, bring up the microphone for Frank again, please.
Or an encouraging word on a computer can go viral too. And that's the gospel spreading the good word.
Good. A good word can go viral, an encouraging word. Very much so.
Okay, just out of curiosity, what is the Jonah sign?
The Jonah sign is, when we went through Jonah, we talked about it could be many things from Jonah, but most would say that when Jonah goes into the deep and he's in the lowest place you can go, the lowest place, that he dies. And then he's raised again to life because he's saying, "I'm in the depths of Sheol," you know, and the language in his poetry is that of death. "And I am at the lowest point, the darkest place, all alone, forgotten by God, in the depths of the grave." And then he's brought back out. And that then connects to the resurrection, becomes a metaphor or a narrative that takes us into resurrection. So the sign of Jonah, I would see, is the resurrection, that it's the resurrection that's going to be the sign that they get. Of course, we'll see in Matthew, as soon as it happens, and this is what's beautiful about Matthew, the Pharisees will actually, I don't know if they team up with the Sadducees. Let me look here very quickly. But very, very quickly, the chief priests met, they heard about the raising from the dead, and "You are to say his disciples came during the night and stole him away." And so they say, here's the story. He didn't really rise, because that can't happen. And it shouldn't happen, and we certainly don't want it to happen for Jesus. So we have that right away. Any other questions, thoughts, comments on today's? I love your modern example, Frank. That's preacher material, man. You were thinking like, I wish I'd thought of that. I feel really dumb. Because that's really good. That's great. I'm glad you brought it out, though. That's the beauty of the community.